Well, hello, everybody. And we are beginning our fifth program on this analysis of the various statements DK has made about the fourth initiation. Well, we've all been very busy with the work of the conference, for the first time, a completely streamed conference. And that has made a big difference. I think overall, you know, it was very successful. And in this modern era, we have to be grateful that technology allows us to remain in place when we must and to still carry on the work. So basically, what I'm going to do is try kind of a new format here. This is a Zoom format, and it is my hope that it all works out well. This is a little bit of an experiment. Usually it's go to meeting of some kind, and we'll just see how this works. And actually, this is the fourth initiation. We'll wait to the fifth initiation a little bit later. And this is a collection of material from DK based upon Zachary Rymill's compilation, which is a very good one and seems to accent what we must accent as we study these matters. From Dinah 2, another question which might well be asked is, do all the members of the group have to be at the same point upon the path of discipleship, or can they be at differing stages of discipleship or initiation? Well, even that's necessary. If you read the beginning of the Rule 11 in the Rays and the Initiations, you will see the need for what is called a miniature hierarchy. And all kinds of people have to be reached, and it's not suitable when only the higher types or lower types are uniform within a group. We need the whole spread. We need the whole gamut of possibilities. So DK goes on and says, what you really mean when you ask this question is, he has the insight, you know, is the group composed of it is as individuals taking the same initiation? Are all its members exactly the same, at exactly the same point in evolution? And DK answers, by no means. A group should be and is composed of individuals at varying degrees of development, and some may be preparing for the second initiation, others may be in training for the third initiation, and a few may be ready for the fourth or the fifth initiation. It seems to imply that everybody in such groups gathered as accepted disciples by the Tibetan have taken the first initiation. There was only one individual in that group who had not, and he was put there for his protection because he had been so helpful in another respect, that is, of publishing Master DK's books on behalf of Alice Bailey. So most were getting ready for the second initiation, and people like Alice Bailey and Roberto Assagioli, I'm pretty confident of this, had taken the third degree and were preparing for the fourth. The nature of the initiation to be undergone is known only to the disciple. and his master. It's a private matter, and you know, so much damage has been done by people claiming initiate status when their quality and behavior absolutely does not demonstrate it. And then all this has caused the whole subject of initiation, as DK has said elsewhere, to fall into disrepute. It is of no interest to the group itself. Well, of course, it is of interest, but it shouldn't be. The diversity of the initiations for which preparation is being made tends to enrich the group content. Now think about that. It's possible to reach a lot more people on a wavelength that they can respond to if there is sufficient qualitative variety in the group. The more ray types which are found functioning in the group, probably, you know, not so much the soul, but the personality types and mental types. DK's group was mostly Ray 2 souls with some Ray 1, and the others, the third Ray and sixth Ray and seventh Ray, no fourth and fifth souls, tended not to be so successful. Maybe there was one third Ray disciple in his soul nature who was somewhat successful, but the other had a lot of problems, and there were overstimulation issues with the seventh Ray disciples for whatever reason. I think one of them had a first Ray monad and it was just too much, you know. So the more valuable will be the service, the more Ray types that are found there. So qualitative variety, not just variety itself, but a variety of quality is needed. It is the bringing together of groups in preparation for initiation which has led to the present basic change in the methods of the hierarchy. This is, after all, the antechamber to the group age of Aquarius. And the isolated disciple or initiate will not be so much found. We've grown up a bit and we can come together and work together, which is certainly needed to cover the kind of education which has to be spread throughout humanity. It's a very big task. A would-be initiate does not, he says, at first work solely under the care of the master of any particular ashram. Certain of the masters, usually masters like myself, who have only lately, 1875, passed through the fifth initiation, have been chosen by whom? Maybe the head of the Ray Ashram that they belong to, maybe Master Kudumi in this case, have been chosen to train and instruct aspirants on all the rays, until after the third initiation of transfiguration. First, DK talked about the training of first and second degree initiates, which was his responsibility, but then he seems to have carried on and taken further his task to include some initiates of the third degree. Then there was one that he specifically pointed out, the group astrologer, actually, who he said, you remind me of myself when I was being prepared for the third initiation. So a great big hint there. But when those hints come, you know, you just cannot have individual or group jealousy of any kind, because it will just stop the group. People are where they are according to what they have done. And their progress will be according to what they, their sensitivity and their expanded consciousness and what they do with that increased consciousness and knowledge. Then and only then does the disciple initiate pass into the ashram of the master of his Rei, one of the senior masters, a Chohan, we would say, a Rei Chohan, Chohan of a Rei Ashram, in connection with the seven major ashrams. There are subsidiaries, of course, and one day there will be 49 altogether that are externalized, but the day is not yet. If he is the disciple in the ashram of a master who is on one of the rays of attributes, the task of the master is to prepare him for transition to one of the major rays of aspect, but that does not necessarily happen. Some very high souls remain on the rays of attribute, and only eventually and finally, when we're talking about logoic, monadic freedom, do we have limitation to one of the three major rays of aspect going on. Just, excuse me, this is a new format for me, and I'm just giving it the old college try and seeing what we can do. This shifting and interchange is taking place all the time. I mean, he gave an example. Some second ray souls switched from the fourth ray to the second. And others did not switch from the fourth ray. And there's a difference between the soul, let us say, that switches from the fourth ray to the second ray, and from the sixth ray to the second ray. And there's a difference when you switch from the sixth ray to the third ray, and when you switch from the fourth ray the sixth ray, I got it now. The sixth ray soul can switch either to the third or to the second ray. And obviously with all those millions of years of background on a particular ray of attribute, there's going to be a difference in the way the third ray is manifested. And the way the second ray is manifested. In my book, The Tapestry of the Gods, I think I go into that a little bit. We all have a peculiar history, you know. We all have thousands of lives we have gone through, and only lately has the curve really started becoming asymptotic, going up more vertically than just dragging along the x-axis, horizontal axis. So now the progress is rapid and we're really making, progress. Excuse the, these COVID-19 days. You don't get to the barber so easily, so I'm going back to my 13th century look. Okay. So this shifting around is taking place all the time. And the last chance, in a way, to shift to one of the major rays of aspect, 1, 2, or 3, is on the logoic plane. Even on the monadic plane, there are seven monadic types. And, when one of those seven begins to be strong, it can be lined up with one of the Chohans of, let me call them the Chohans of attribute, a Rei Ashram of attribute, like the unnamed seventh Rei master Chohan, the Chohan Jesus, the Chohan Paul of Tarsus or Hilarion, we can call him, the Chohan Master Serapis. Okay. And you can work there from the perspective of what you're doing on the monadic plane. But then, when the monad flies free and becomes a temporarily liberated volatile essence, a flying essence, as it were, it's got to be one of the three, Father, Son, or Holy Ghost. One through three cosmic logoi, along with the solar logos, who really is a cosmic logos in a sense. Cosmic being, anyway. When, for instance, now pay attention here, when, for instance, the Master R assumed the task of the Maha Chohan, or Lord of Civilization, you know, he had a third ray monad, and is it a double third ray monad? Pretty much he's a sixth degree initiate, and so we just don't know. The seventh degree initiates are those who have liberation onto the logoic plane. The others have a sevenfold choice, such as the Master R. The Master R assumed the task of Maha Chohan, or Lord of Civilization. When he did that, his ashram was shifted from the seventh ray of ceremonial order to the third ray of active intelligence. Some people forget that, and they just think of Master R as the seventh ray master, but really he's in charge of ashrams 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And he's in a much greater supervisory position on the great third ray of intelligence, which is certainly his first monadic ray, and we don't know, is it his second and highest monadic ray or expression. So the majority of those who have taken the second and third initiations in his department, yeah, were transferred with him under what might be called a special dispensation. Because here's the thing about the seventh ray, it's so often transferred to ray one. And it's ray four and ray six that can be transferred to ray three. But this was a special dispensation. And I suppose a lot of those on the seventh ray, and especially those with third ray monads, went with him onto the third ray under special dispensation. All of these ray movements, you know, are quite intricate, and one day we'll know the how and the why of it. But let's just say hierarchy is adaptable and adequate to the need. The rest of the members of his ashram remained for tuition, which means teaching and training, in service under the master who took his place as the central point of the seventh ray ashram. So we are talking about transference of seventh ray types with initiates of the second and third degree adding to their seventh ray a powerful expression on the third ray, you know. So there's so many manifestational things they will be in charge of, and financial issues, because finances determine what shall be materialized. And these are two great rays of form, the seventh ray and the third ray. The seventh ray, more particular form, more exacting form, the ray of exact arrangement, and the third ray, the ray of a more general externalization, never so fine in detail as is the seventh ray. Fourth degree initiates and above are custodians of the plan. Well, we've been talking about the fourth initiation, even though it's out of our reach and has to be approached as a privilege when we are ready and not all emotional and ambitious about it. Fourth degree initiates are above are custodians of the plan. Somehow they register from the monad and from the atomic plane what really does need to be materialized. So here's Dyna 2, page 391. And, you know, if you just want to think about these things, I suppose you just press your space bar somehow and pauses, and then you can, you know, dwell on these matters. Or there are ways to expand to a full screen, regardless of how it arrives for you, and you will, you know, see more and clearer. Because some of this print is pretty small, but Zach kept it that way, enlarging the things that he felt were really important. And I tend to agree with him, you know, in almost all choices. So that we could really have them have an impact upon us. Souls, that's what we all are, because soul is a cosmic principle, really. Even the triad is a soul. Even the monad has soul. Unusual to think about that. Monad has this awareness, this consciousness, which can be named soul. Soul, that is, those initiates who have taken the fourth initiation, souls. It's so interesting, isn't it? That they're really called souls when they've taken the fourth initiation, when they're still hanging out in the causal body, and, you know, the egoic lotus. They are learning what soul really is from its own plane of serviceable materialization, but they are not liberated the way a fourth degree initiate is liberated in touch with the monad. And, you know, even the fourth degree initiate would say, I'm not liberated yet. And so would the fifth degree say so. And, you know, all the way up the ladder until we reach the cosmic universal logos, the universal logos, who would say, okay, you know, I am not liberated yet. Not until the universe, any one of an infinite number. Is there such a thing as an infinite number? Well, some say so. Until the universe itself, any universe, of which there have been countless in a way, dissolves or is somehow dematerialized back into the state of the trans-universal deity, the utmost deity that is super-universal. But, you know, more on that when we study together identification as being, which is a, you know, different kind of course already, but I can't help but mention these things. Souls, that is, those initiates who have taken the fourth initiation of renunciation, and in whom the soul body, the causal body, has been destroyed, though I would say the debris not entirely dissipated, so the revelation is not complete, which is the name of the fifth initiation. They are the custodians of the plan. They know much more in detail, maybe not everything, course, because even masters, I think, just know the first syllable of the true name of Sanat Kumara. Either the first syllable, and some only know the first letter. So there are limitations, even at those, for us, relatively high states. Well, we are by no means custodians of the plan. We are, nor are we registrants of the purpose, even higher. We are simply those who remain alert and sensitive to catch a glimmer of the divine plan in a limited horizon, within a limited horizon, and how it applies to what we have become through ever-descending emanation until we have reached the human form. Soul-infused personalities, these are the disciples and initiates of the first three initiations, though through whom the souls work in carrying out the plan. Well, you know, I think just before the fourth initiation, you're maximally soul-infused in that limited sense, but you're not a true soul. You know, keep in mind, I just put it in here, keep in mind what a true soul is. You know, an initiate of the fourth degree. So we are aspirants toward the state of soul. And when we learn to contemplate, you know, we're really taking the first step there of actually identifying within the meditation of a soul, at least a soul as it manifests on the higher mental plane. Now, one day with Antikarana more completed than it is now, we will, as fourth degree initiates do, find the locus of our concentration to be on the Buddhic plane, which is not yet the case for the third degree initiate, though he strives to do so. So we have a, you know, kind of a description here of three types: souls, soul-infused personalities who are guided by the souls, you know, and intelligent aspirants who are not yet soul-infused personalities, as I sometimes say, who are soul-infusing personalities, but who recognize the necessity of the plan and who seek the welfare of their fellow man. Sounds like they are, you know, candidates or members, candidates for or members of the new group of world servers. So just think about these spheres of duty that these different types have. The highest group formulates the plan. You know, it descends maybe from those who really are custodians of the purpose, and they have taken pretty much the sixth degree or our very high fifth degree initiates. The highest group formulates the plan. The second group modifies, qualifies, and adapts the plan to contemporary human requirements and thus ensures the gradual and steady continuity of the plan. So they match what the highest expression of the plan is to the time and place in which they find themselves, and they pay a lot of attention about to bringing that plan into useful contact with circumstances as they exist at their present time. And the third group are the agents, you know, the hands and feet, so to speak, who carry this plan to mankind. So what we've got is the head, the torso and the heart, and then the arms and legs, basically. So the continuity of the plan, the third group are the agents who carry this plan to mankind and seek to make it workable, guided by spiritual compromise, you know, righteous compromise, correct compromise, and the compromise evidenced by the second group. You know, the second ray and fourth ray are the great compromisers, and it's in that particular position that the modification, qualification, and adaptation occurs. Now, what are we doing, you know? Well, maybe we're qualifying and adapting. We can't modify the plan too much because we don't know enough. Then he goes on to say, you know, once the fourth initiation is taken and the monad is coming into much fuller and direct expression, the monad is to the planetary logos what the third eye is to man. The third eye allows us to see things whole and in unitive relationship. And I suppose the monad allows the, it's like an eye, and an all-seeing eye, and especially the collection of monads, as there is really only one monad. You say, well, there are many monads, but really they're all one. And how many monads are there in the universe? Well, it's all one monad, a Greek term, and you'll see that it basically means one, monas, and you get that in monk, M-O-N, and monastery. It's somebody who's really concentrating on the factor of oneness and how to see all things in that particular way. So through what eye are we seeing? There's a whole collection. We'll have to do sometime a discussion of the different kinds of eyes that we have, opening perception to different levels of energy system of man, and the kind of level at which each of those eyes works in the larger sense. You know, the third eye and the eye of the soul are not the same, and obviously they're not the same as the monad. So these are finer distinctions, and I think in our Ageless Wisdom compilation, we have some compilation on the eyes, or the eye, and I think it's worth going there, joining, and in yahoogroups.com, and having access to those compilations. DK said, look, study topically. Well, you know, topical study is very vertical. Reading the book is very horizontal. Together they make the cross. I would say, you know, study both ways. But topical study does bring together many important points on the same subject, and then you get an intensified realization of what that's all about, of what, you know, a deeper view of the subject. So sometimes, you know, on top of the American dollar bill, on top of the pyramid is this all-seeing eye. And we just have to assume it's our planetary logos, and the eye is kind of the monad. You know, what's really interesting, it just flashed on me that when you're taking initiation, Sanat Kumara at the fourth initiation appears before you as an eye, maybe an Egyptian eye. Now, this is the first time that there is a much freer access to the monad. So we have the idea of the initiator, the all-seeing eye, and the monad at the fourth degree. A lot of things are out of the way by that time, but of course the sincerity and the sacrifice are deeply required, and we can say a lot about it, but until we do it, we haven't, you know, proven that we are willing, let's say. These are mysterious words. Indeed they are. You know, one can ponder them, just like DK said, I once was given a hint that all ashrams are found upon the Antikarana. Sounds obvious, but he had to go away for a long time pondering it before he kind of realized what it really meant. So these are mysterious words and can only be understood if brought into relation with the previous revelation involving the will and the law of sacrifice. I guess these are on the points of revelation, which we could take up, you know, separately. That's the thing about topical study. It leaves out some of the connected issues. But then again, if it's going to be topical, you can't wander all over the place. You have to stick to the main subject. even though there are tendrils going out and touching other things, but you can't go too far afield. It should be remembered that the law of sacrifice, in its destroying aspect, dominant during the second, is dominant during the second, third, and fourth initiations. Well, second initiation, Mars is overcome by Vulcan. Third initiation, even more so. Vulcan, the spiritual will, dominates. Fourth initiation, Scorpio overcomes Leo. And the limited meaning of the sun is overcome by Pluto. And this is a period in which the base of the spine is already active and contributing to the kundalinic destruction of the causal body. There are many ways, well, several ways in which the causal body is destroyed. And some of those methods are coming from the Buddhic plane, and some are coming from below, and some are coming from the atomic triangle. There's just not going to be anything left except the debris of that individual supernova we call the destruction of the causal body. And then the clearing comes so that revelation can appear at the fifth degree, and what's revealed pretty much the meaning of the paths that you might take, seven and now nine, and what might be appropriate for you, because DK seems to say there's only one choice, really, one correct choice, and the Buddha didn't make it. He stayed out of love too long, which is hard for us to grasp, you know. You know, in that way, he's like the planetary logos who made an error on the moon chain through premature compassion, releasing a great and unconscious elemental life, which wreaked havoc on the moon chain and still has repercussions on the earth chain. So we don't know what the repercussions are, and DK says that the Buddha's so-called sin was very understandable, you know. But and indeed, in terms of the second ray, it is. Now, the curious thing is that in the next solar system, the forces of retrogression will work through love and not will, or at least a certain form of attachment to what is called love will prevent the full expression of will. Just like now, a very keen and acute intelligence husbanded by those entities who are extremely intelligent and selfish prevents the true expression of love, or at least gets in the way. You know, we're talking about things beyond us, but DK gives us enough information that we can make some sense out of it. Now, let's see what further is said. At the second initiation, of the baptism in the River Jordan, you know, John the Baptist was a Gemini, he tells us, and I'll just bet with strong Pisces, some affiliation with water and cleansing, the control of the astral body is broken. Well, we may feel things intensely and desire to do this and that, but it doesn't dominate us. It is sacrificed in order that the intuition, the higher counterpart of the propelling aspiration, as it is sometimes called, may assume control. So we seem to be getting the flickerings of intuition coming in as the second initiation is taken. And, I have often read out loud the beginning of Glamour World Problem, you know, page 234, right in there, where it defines what intuition really is, you know, and it has to do with a great and in exclusive love and not with some kind of psychic intelligence that usually has that name. At the initiation of transfiguration, the third degree, that more and more disciples can begin to take, and especially in the age of Capricorn, the control of the personality in the three worlds is broken. It's still useful instrument, but it doesn't run away with the show, you know. It's like there's a jockey and there's a horse. Now, if the horse runs away and the jockey loses control, obviously the race is over for that particular unit. So the control of the personality in the three worlds, and so many of us are thus controlled, at least at certain times, is broken. Well, we've got a lot of Vulcan in there to help bringing in spiritual will and the will of the soul to break that ancient control of the personality. In order that the son of mind, the soul may be substituted finally with a concrete and hitherto directing lower mind. Lower mind has everything to do with personality, and it's on that same level of lower mind that personality is generated, pretty much at the fourth subplane of the mental plane. But if we want to get into our first demonstration of real soul, we'll go into the higher mind. It's certainly not the last demonstration of soul. It's soul within a vehicle. It's a sword within a scabbard. The soul goes all the way up to the top. We have to remember that. But if we're talking about the soul within the causal body or the soul within the egoic lotus, that means a very specific thing and is usually meant, when we say soul, that's usually the meaning. Again, through the law of sacrifice, the sacrifice petals opening up, they are mental petals, and the sacrificial will is coming in. The personality is liberated and becomes simply an agent of the soul. Well, let's just say, the personality can become a pretty interesting dweller on the threshold, exemplifying acute development of the third aspect of divinity, intelligence. But this is a kind of liberation where personality just doesn't get its way because it's asserting itself. The real man is gaining more and more control. Now, this is a little study here on the fourth initiation. At the fourth initiation of renunciation, that's what it's called, particularly in the East, we know, and crucifixion in the West, the destroying aspect of the law of sacrifice brings about the destruction of the causal body. And that's one of the factors that causes destruction. And at the fourth initiation, there's kind of like a drawing and quartering, kind of a ghastly way of death, but things are divided by pulling in all the different directions, especially the directions of the cross. And the fourth ray is a combination, in my view anyway, of the first ray and second ray. First ray first for conflict, and second ray eventually for harmony. So there is a destroying aspect here, and there's a lot of Scorpio in this law of sacrifice where you give up something for something better. You give up something of lesser quality for something better. So it brings about the destruction of the causal body. The soul body, in order that the unified soul-infused personality, and it's very soul-infused by the time the fourth degree can be taken, and you have, as DK says, 100% atomic matter in the areas of the different vehicles, which pretty much means dematerialization on the lower level. In order that the unified soul-infused personality may function directly under the inspiration of the spiritual triad. Inspiration, it's of God, it's of the highest aspect, it's the breath which connects with the highest aspect, the first aspect of divinity, the life aspect. And finally, the Antikorana is built as much as a human being can build it, at least up to that point, because you can continue with the Antikorana, obviously, when it's finally built to the monad, which is still later. We've pretty much reached the end of the methods of building for the members of the fourth creative hierarchy. So directly under the inspiration of the spiritual triad, which is like the personality of the monad, it's the triple expression or instrument of the monad, just the way the personality with which we are familiar is the instrument of the soul. All these things lie ahead of us, and we just have to prepare wisely. The significance of these, quote, destructive episodes which produce the freeing of the prisoner of the planet, whether the prisoners, you know, many elemental lives, and they are certainly upgraded at that time. But here we're talking about the divine spiritual man, which is usually forced to dwell for millions of years within the elemental nature we call the personality. So it's freedom. It's suffering in the sense of loss of attachment to that to which we are commonly attached, you know, and there's a rending process. The veil of the temple is rent in twain, but the divine spiritual man, ultimately the monad, and certainly that which is within the triad and within the causal body is freed, or at least has gained a greater degree of freedom. Destructive episodes which produce the freeing of the prisoner, singular, of the planet, the divine spiritual man. The significance lies in the fact that after the fourth initiation, the light of purpose is the sole controlling factor in the career of the initiate. And he enters then upon a stage wherein he steadily approaches to the center where the will of God is known. The custodians of the purpose bestow that of which they are the custodian upon the newly made initiate, and they do it in a measured manner, and we're driven by the higher aspect. It sometimes seems to me that the spiritual triad is a blend of the higher aspect and the soul aspect. Just the way there are elements about the soul in its egoic lotus vehicle, which are combining the second aspect and the third, even though the first is represented as the jewel in the lotus. So we're going to approach closer and closer to the will of God, and right now all of us just have the faintest idea of what that might be, but you know, you do feel the difference perhaps when you are driven by something which we recognize as divine purpose, even though we don't really understand it. It is an elementary revelation, notice the word elementary, of the divine purpose which is given at the third initiation, the first real initiation. Only the first stage of that mysterious, all-embracing purpose is at that time revealed. The remaining six initiations, up till nine, progressively reveal to the master, you know, because he's attained that, the all-enfolding purpose, which probably has a whole lot to do with the place within the solar system and creating a great station of light and becoming the Kundalini power, the base of the spine power to the solar logos, and assisting the solar logos to take finally the fifth initiation, where base of spine and the top of the head represented by the solar logos or sun are combined, base of the spine, Pluto, Earth especially, and its relationship to the sun or the solar logos, brought out especially in eclipse relationships. That's the kind of power that can be released at eclipses. Earlier I told you that three words should be considered in relation to the points of revelation. And I guess that's what we're studying here. You never quite know when you're doing the topical study where you're landing. A procedure, location, and objective. All three of them are of use here in considering the nature of the impending revelation. And you know, it all leads to mastership, which is called the initiation of revelation. The recognition of these points of revelation falls automatically into two main procedures or planned processes. We're obviously going to try to do things right and do it by the book. And according to the rules, this is no time for improvisation. Occultism is a science, and we have to approach in a scientific manner before we can wield what we have learned artfully, artistically. So let's see what we have here. The fourth point of revelation and the fourth initiation, it's the destroying aspect of the will. There's also the creative aspect and the sustaining aspect. But the destroying aspect is the liberating aspect because it detaches us from lower preoccupations which prevent our moving onward. So the recognition of these points of revelation falls automatically into two major main procedures. The fourth point of revelation and the fourth initiation, this is the topic, the destroying aspect of the will. So from Dyna 402, passing on to the fourth point of revelation, I guess, would I dare do this? I don't really have this handy, so I'll just stay where I am. But basically, look onto 402 in Dyna 2, and probably the various points of revelation will there be found. Purpose itself, this is the point, is only an energy released within the council chamber of Shambhala, and there it takes shape. In case we think that what's going on in Shambhala is amorphous, formless, it's not. I've already shown the statement by the Tibetan that the patterns created in Shambhala on the highest plane are of consummate beauty. We're still on the cosmic physical plane, remember. Whether there are higher correspondences to Shambhala for the sacred planets and for the solar logoi and so forth, probably there are, but we have enough to deal with just trying to understand Shambhala, into which one cannot blithely waltz unless one is an initiate of the fifth degree on the first ray, or otherwise a Chohan of the sixth degree on the other rays. So purpose itself is only an energy released within the council chamber at Shambhala. This point of revelation carries the initiate to one of the highest points of contemplation. And there are many points. In the East, they categorize these points. All contemplation leads to samadhi, you know, which is a blissful, unitive state of realized oneness, but there are all kinds of samadhis. And thus the Oriental mind divided these abstract states very distinctly and probably with a lot of argument about what was correct. You know, the Orient has the fourth ray soul, but the third ray argumentative personality and the different schools and the different approaches, they all argue. It has nothing to do with really experiencing the truth. So we are here concerned with his, the initiative of the fourth degree, I guess, with his sudden apprehension at the fourth initiation of renunciation, where an entirely new scope of experiences is opened up to us, of another phase of the divine, conditioning will. Yet another phase of the will. Probably all these aspects of the will are divided and subdivided, but we don't want to necessarily get into so many mental subdivisions that we lose the possibility of experience. He has begun to recognize and to interpret, even though in an elementary fashion, compared to what he will recognize at the ninth initiation. Oh goodness, you know, the Christ is even far from that, the destroying aspect of the will as it expresses itself through the law of sacrifice. As Masamoria said, when have you ever become less through sacrifice? And the sacrifice demanded is greater and greater until we meet such a being as Sanatkumara, who is known as the great sacrifice. And of course, there are great, still greater sacrifices beyond the one that he is making. You know, sacrifice all the way up, because it is the relinquishing of misidentifications. If I'm going to look at sacrifice, it may be very painful because we love our identifications and we adhere to them. We are attached to them, and we can't imagine ourselves letting go of them, but the relinquishing of those misidentifications liberates us. So, you know, 401, 402 here in Dyna 2 has a lot of important information. So yet another phase of the conditioning will. He has begun to recognize and to interpret, even though in an elementary fashion, compared to what he will recognize at the ninth initiation, how many thousands and thousands, or even, I don't know, would it be millions of years ahead, will that lie? The destroying aspect of the will as it expresses itself through the law of sacrifice. But what is destroyed is limitation. And sometimes it's very hard for us to give up our limitations. You sometimes hear about people who have committed a crime and spent 40 or 50 years in prison, and they don't want to leave. It's home. And so they go out and commit some kind of petty crime just so they can get back to home, to that which they've identified with their prison. And human beings have a tendency to do that if exposed for a long time. And we have been exposed for a long time to the elemental life of the personality. Now, for the first time, as a result of destruction, he can begin to grasp the essential building aspect of this same will. It's more the second aspect, isn't it? And to apply his future function as a creative builder. It kind of looks like the third and second ray are involved there together. The building here to be carried forward, I would remind you, is not the building which is distinctive of the second divine aspect. That clarifies, right? That of love, wisdom. It is strictly connected with that of the first aspect of purpose. It looks like every aspect has its 1, 2, 3, okay? So, you know, there is the sustaining, building will. You know, oftentimes represented by zodiacally by Capricorn and Leo. Well, Capricorn, the will that conquers death, Leo, the will to fulfillment, and Aries, the will to create. So we have to line up these correspondences at some point and have them be meaningful. It is strictly connected with that of the first aspect of purpose, power, or will. It deals with the processes which precede the active creative building. The drawing up of the blueprints in those old days, I guess we, you know, right now we have these computer programs which make blueprints really antiquated, if I may use such a term. The drawing up of the blueprints, and we might say the abstract mind is involved there somehow, within the confines of Shambhala. So it's a real causal nature that exists up there, in there, and it has to do with the outlines, the final archetypes, which must be fulfilled below. And the third aspect of divinity under the first probably is involved. So let me read this again. It deals with the processes which precede the actual creative building, the drawing up of the blueprints, if I may use such a term, within the confines of Shambhala, where high spiritual beings must lay their plans. It's not only within hierarchy and in the atmic plane where the plans are laid, but within Shambhala itself, including esoterically then the monadic plane and the logoic plane. I imagine the council chamber of Shambhala to be on the logoic plane. This is a different process to the creative building process and is related to a mysterious undertaking which is carried forward under the law of assembly. In come the energies, they have to be assembled into archetypes according to the thought of our chain lord and globe lord and probably our scheme lord, related in a certain way. Given the materials, you relate them a certain way, which is archetypal, and then, only then, do you attempt to materialize them. This is pretty abstract stuff, isn't it? And we just have the possibility of maybe having a little hint about it. Well, I think, you know, we may be there. I have this peculiar feeling. I don't even know whether this recording took, because it's really, really new to me using this particular format. So I'm going to really hope, and I'm going to stop at an hour, or very roughly an hour, and see if satisfaction is my lot, or whether I have frustration because nothing really happened. Law of assembly, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Okay, I think we didn't even get that far. It's the law of assembly, and we're about to begin page 403. We don't cover a lot of pages. So this is the end of page 5. And basically, we're somewhere here on page 12, it looks like. Page 12. We begin on page 12. So this will be page 8 to probably page 11. And this will be program 6 coming up. And basically, we'll be at page 11. Program number 6, we will begin, and page 11 on this document. Okay, friends, cross your fingers. I'm crossing mine and just hoping that this actually did record. You know, I've lost many programs confidently wading in only to discover that I forgot to press a certain button and thereby wasted time. So I'll get to the next part when I can get to it. Okay, and this is then the end of this particular work. Stop recording.